We're holding on page 18 in Gittin Oischof Vav. We learned previously about the area called Tur Malka or Har HaMelech in Lashon Kodesh, a thickly populated area of Eretz Yisrael. We said there were an enormous number of cities in there, each with an enormous population, and that was the second place that we were talking about in the sugya that was destroyed. We had Yerushalayim, and then we had Tur Malka. So now the Gemara continues with a related topic. Now this place that we're going to talk about over here in this next piece in Oischof Vav is the Pashtus, not part of Tur Malka, but the Gemara is going to we'll talk about what the connection is between it and the previous piece. So the Gemara says Rav Manumi bar Chilkiya, Rav Chilkiya bar Tovia, Rav Huna bar Chia, these three chachamim, Havu Yasvi, Gabi Adodi, they were sitting together. Amri, and they said between themselves, if there's anybody over here who's heard anything about the place called Kfar Schania Shel Mitzrayim, Lema, then tell it. We want to know where the Tzadikim or Rishoyim. The Pashtus Shel Mitzrayim means that it was located in Egypt, and Kfar Schania was the name of the place. It might also conceivably mean that the people who lived there were from Mitzrayim and then emigrated to Eretz Yisrael. Whatever the case, the point is it was a city that had been destroyed, maybe not long before this, and they wanted to know, so what can we tell about the people who were there? Plus a chad minay over Omar. So one of them started and told the following story. Maisa ba'orus va'arusose. It happened with a man and woman who were, they'd done kiddushin, but they hadn't yet done nisuin, and they were from that city. Shanishbul ben agoyim, who were taken captive among the goyim. The Hithium, Zelazen, and the Goyim married them off to one another, figuring naturally enough, I mean, maybe the Goyim knew they were already engaged, maybe not, but the point is, the Goyim obviously figured they'll get more slave children from them. However, Omraloi, but the woman says, the Kala says to her chosin, b'vakoshimimcho al tigabi, I'm asking you, don't touch me. We shouldn't have relations, she'in li ksuba mimcho, because I have no ksuba from you. They'd only done the erusin. Now it can happen sometimes that they write the ksuba during the time of the erusin, and then he pledges the money towards the ksuba. Such things can happen. The Gemara discusses it in Masechta Ksubas. But ordinarily, the ksuba only comes into effect at the time of the nisuin, when they do the chuppah, and when they consummate their marriage. So here, there was no opportunity to make a ksuba. Why not? There's a number of reasons why. Marshall gives a reason. Because to have a ksuba, you need to have money. You have to pledge 200 zuz, or 100 if he's not a basula. He didn't have. He's a slave to the goyim. Marshall kona eved kona rabba. Whatever he owns is going to belong to his master.
Do you really have to own this money while you're doing the ksuba?
Apparently, the Marshall is learning that at least you have to have the ability, conceivably, to be able to have it at the time. And here he doesn't have that ability. Which actually the Rif over here wonders why. I mean, basically, like you were saying, they could have done a Kenyan Suder about that he will pledge it for the future or something like that. So yeah, the Rif here on any act of Taka wonders why they didn't use such a method. So Marsha mentions, what about the fact of the lack of Nisuin? Now, Marsha explains that we're going to have in the continuation of the story that she speaks to people and tells them about the greatness of her chosen and what a tremendous Nisuin he withstood. Marsha learns that those people she's speaking to are Jews. In that case, there are 10 Jews over there. Well, then, they could have made Birkas Nisuin, they could have made a Chuppah and had the Nisuin. That wouldn't have been the problem. The problem was the lack of a Ksuba. Not everybody agrees to that, though, and in fact, Ben Yehoyada discusses a number of possibilities, one of them being that indeed maybe they didn't have 10 Jews over there, maybe the people that she's speaking to are, maybe they were Jews who showed up only afterwards, maybe they're even the Goyim who were there, whatever, the point is, so it may very well be, in fact, it may very well be, he says, that therefore they couldn't have a Ksuba and they couldn't have a Chuppah. You think about it, and, you know, imagine, for example, a Yid ends up, like, on a desert island or something, you know, there's no Jews around. He Taka might be stuck for life, because to make a Jewish wedding, you need to have Edom, and you need to have a Minyan. So therefore, so they didn't. V'lenogabad yoimoysa, and sure enough, he didn't touch her until the day he died. Uchshemeth, when this man passed away, Omra lahen, she says to them. Now, who are the them? Again, according to Marashah, the them is the other Jews who were in captivity with them. Ben Yehoyada brings up a whole bunch of other possibilities. It might be actually she was saying to the Goyim, that Goyim, should realize what an outstanding person you had among you. It could be my Ben Yehoyadis has another possibility. Maybe they were Jews, but none of them knew how to write, so therefore they couldn't write a ksuba. Although I don't know, because sort of even on that a little bit, the Gemara does mention in ksubas that there were places where b'chlal they had the minhag not to write a ksuba in the first place, and they would just rely on the fact that there's a tznai based in of the ksuba. So in that case, maybe they wouldn't have needed a written one. But anyway, he goes on to say maybe there were only women over there. Another possibility Ben Yehoyada says is maybe the people she's speaking to, Jews, finally found out. Eventually, this couple have been taken captive. Eventually, the local Jews found out there were Jews over there. We need to do pidyon shavuyim. And by the time they came, or by the time they'd raised the money or whatever, the chosen had passed away, and therefore she's telling them. So she is speaking to Jews then, but these Jews were not available when they were needed. Anyway, she says to them, whoever it is that she's speaking to, according to all these possibilities, she tells them, siftu lazeh, mourn for this purpose, for this mourn for this person, shepitbit b'yitzroi yosef mi yosef. He pitpit against his Yetzirah even more than Yosef. Rashi translates pitpit as zilzol Yitzri. He considered his Yetzirah unimportant. Elsewhere, you have also this expression, pitpit b'Yitzri, that Ashbam, and in Baba Basra, we're talked about in connection with Yosef over there also, says that means that he fought against his Yetzirah. So whatever, the point is, in other words, that he conquered, whether he accomplished it by belittling it, saying to the Yetzirah, you're nothing, I don't have to listen to you, or whether he actually fought against it, whatever the case, he did in a way even greater than Yosef. With Yosef, it was only for a little while, it was 1 year that Potiphar's wife is after him, but still, it's only a short time, relatively. Here it was every single day. Furthermore, with Yosef, they weren't in the same bed. Here, of necessity, they were in the same bed, because after all, the Goyish captors had married them off to each other. As far as their Goyish masters are concerned, they're husband and wife. And yet they didn't have relations, whereas at least Potiphar's wife never actually got Yosef into bed with her. Furthermore, with Yosef, she wasn't after all his wife. He knew that she is Potiphar's wife, and she's off limits to him. She is his wife in a certain sense. They had already done the Erusin, so he could have rationalized to himself that it's not so bad without a ksuba, and nevertheless he withstood his Yetzirah. Maharsha points out that actually there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that, now, the one Mephoshim will point out, on the other hand, it is true, in a way, though, Yosef beats him in the fact that, after all, Yosef, Yad Potiphar's wife, is trying to seduce him, whereas he, or Faker, she's telling him, keep your hands off me. So in that sense, Yosef's temptation was greater, but still. Maharsha points out there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that tells us that as great as Yosef's Nisoyan was, Boaz withstood a still greater Nisoyan, and Palti ben Laish, an even greater one than that. The Gemara tells us that in Sanhedrin, with Boaz, you have the part in Megillas Rus, where Ruth comes to the granary at night and sleeps by his feet, and he wakes up in the middle of the night and discovers her over there. And with Potiphar's wife, he knows she's off limits to him. With Boaz and Ruth, she's an unmarried woman at this point. She's an Amona. He could have been Moda Heter to himself, especially as it turned out he is the Goyal and he is the one to marry her. So he could have easily rationalized to himself, and he didn't. So in that sense, his Nisoyan that he withstood was the much greater one. And Palti ben Laish is a whole story involving David's first wife, Michal, with Shaul. When we get to Masechta Sanhedrin in a couple of years, Be'ez Hashem, we'll talk about more of the details about it. But the gist of it is that there was machloikas and halacha between Shaul and David, whether David's marriage to Michal was b'chlal valid halacha, so he took her away and gave her in marriage to another fellow named Palti ben Laish, and he never touched her and never acted towards her as husband and wife during all the years when they were together. That was an even greater Nisoyan than Boaz, where after all, as far as Shaul is concerned, they are married. In any case, Maharsha says, here you have this person then, you can say he's greater than Yosef in three ways, the three ways that we said over here. He's greater than Boaz in two ways, because again, there it was only one night and she wasn't his wife, and even greater than Palti, because she wasn't truly his wife, since she was Mekodesh to David, but yet did have it for many years, and they were together in one bed. So, actually, mind you, Rabbi Yaakov Emden wonders over here on the Gemara, how are they even allowed to be together in the same bed, but I guess Boaz is not much of a choice. But anyway, the point is, but definitely relative to Yosef, he was greater in these three ways. Okay, so we see from that story that we have an example of a Stama couple from this town who were outstanding in their tzidkus.
What does it have to do with Skanya and Mitzrayim?
The name of the place was Kfar Skanya from Mitzrayim. So what happened was, apparently at some point, yes. This, apparently this, these people were from that town, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Rashi says, Me'oi Sahir, they were from that town, yeah. Pasach Idach V'Amo, another one of these three Chachamim who was sitting together and discussing Kfar Sanya Shomitzrayim, another one told the following story, also that took place in Kfar Sanya Shomitzrayim. Maisa V'Amdu Aboyim Modius V'Dinner. The price of wheat in that town, in that area, was 40 modius for one dinar. Modia is a unit of measurement. Then the price was lacking one modia. In other words, the price, there was inflation, and now instead of being able to buy 40 modius for a dinar, you could buy only 39. So they realized something is wrong. Ubodku Matsu, they checked into it, and they found that in that town of Ubnoi Shaboa Naira Maurosa Yom Kippurim, a father and son who had been Mizana with a Naira Maurosa on Yom Kippur, which is a horrible Avera, but obviously that father and son were no tzaddikim, but nevertheless, they have Yom the Beistin. The point is, first of all, we see the very fact that the people in that town realize that the problem with the economy must be because of an Avera, rather than who would do that nowadays. You'd start looking at the Wall Street Journal or whatever to find out. You'd start looking on Twitter to see what's going on, what's going on with the latest economic forecast and all that. They realize the important thing is you have to look in how it is up in Torah. Also the fact that the punishment itself was so minor that the prices went up slightly rather than something more serious. So those alone are two reasons to show that everybody else there were tzaddikim. So they brought them to Beis Din the Stockholm and they gave them skila, as is the punishment for having relations with a Naira Maradasa. V'chazer ashal l'mekomei, and the price went back to what it was. From which we see, therefore, that among other things, Marsha points out, that shows that was obviously the only Avera in town. It's a horrible Avera, but it was one single Avera, and once they got rid of that, then things are back to normal. So that also shows that the rest of the town there were tzaddikim. So that story also tells us that basically the people of Kfar Sanya were tzaddikim. Pasach Idach V'Amar, then the third one told the following story. There was a man living in the Kfar Sanya who decided he wanted to divorce his wife. Now, this is long before Cherem Dei Geshem, so he could divorce her without her consent. The problem is, her ksuba payment was very large, and he couldn't or wouldn't afford it. Ma'osa, so what did he do? He decided he's going to play a trick to cause that there should be reason for him to be able to divorce her and that she should forfeit her ksuba. One way in which a wife might forfeit her ksuba is if she's mizana, if she makes herself also to her husband with znus. So, ma'asa, what did he do? Holach v'ziminis shushvinav, he invited his shushvinin, his really close friends. Nowadays, we use shushvinin to mean the unterfeerers, but more in Gemara terminology, it means good friends. In particular, it means the Gemara describes in Baba Basra a whole system that they would have, where you'd have a circle of friends, where each of them basically would help contribute towards the, when each one of them, when he's getting married, everybody else in the group would contribute towards the wedding expenses, and they would be invited to the wedding, and the understanding was when the next one of the group gets married, then they're going to do the same thing. Anyway, so he invited his shushvinim, v'achivan v'hishkan, he gave them food and drink, shikran, he got them drunk, v'hishkivan al mita achas, and he had them all lie together on one bed, together with his wife. She was also b'pashtos asleep and drunk. V'hevi loivin v'etza, then he took raw egg white, v'hito b'nehen, and poured it on the bed between them, because egg white looks a lot like shechvazera. So this way, it's going to look as though there was znus going on over here. So this way, it actually says, he'll start spreading a rumor that they had relations with his wife, and that she was mizana, and then what are they doing in the same bed as her? Now Marsha points out that when you get down to it, technically this wouldn't be all by itself reason enough for him to be able to divorce her and her forfeit her ksuba either. This is something called edekir. This is something you don't have edim for directly for the znus, but you have edekir. They see that there was something ugly over here. There's something that causes us to suspect that something went wrong. But the point is, Marsha says that's why we see obviously in this story, again, this particular husband is a lowlife, but nevertheless we see that in town they would have been ready to ask her to her husband and to make her and to cause that she should get divorced just based on Edekir, even without having stronger evidence than that. But what happened? How was his plot exposed? The Hemid Lehen Edim, and then he set up Edim to go and testify that they had seen this. And then he comes to Beis Din claiming that he has reason to divorce his wife. However, there was an elder Talmud Chacham there in town from the Talmudim of Shammai HaZaken. Bava ben Butta Shmoy, his name is Bava ben Butta. This is the famous Bava ben Butta that we have in a number of places in Shas. Which, by the way, Maharsha points out, he lived long before the Churban. This whole story that we're talking about, Kfar Chanya Shel Mitzrayim being destroyed, was sometime after the Churban. Because the Gemara is going to say they weren't mourning over Yerushalayim the way they're supposed to. So Bava ben Butta was a long time before that. The point is, though, that we see that just as at that time there were tzaddikim, as we explained the story, the same way in back in Bava ben Butta's time, the same way as in Bava ben Butta's times, they still were, they still retained that tzidkus a couple hundred years later at the time of the Churban. So Bava ben Butta Shmoy, Omalahem, he tells them, Kach mekublani mishamei hazaken, I have the following Kabbalah from my Rebbe, from Shammai HaZaken. Here's how you can tell the difference between egg white versus shechvas zera, loiven beitz a solid min ha'ur. When you apply heat to it, egg white will dry up and harden because of the fire, like when you boil an egg, the egg white, because the egg white solidifies. Will go and get absorbed. It'll soften and moisten and go and get absorbed into the sheet rather than hardening. So they checked, they applied heat to it, and sure enough, they found it did exactly what he said, and it turned out that it was egg white. They have yule the basin, so they brought the fellow to basin, the hokuhu, and they gave him malchus, there is the case of motzi shemra al ishtoi, where a man goes to basin and claims that his wife was mizana during the erusin. This wasn't strictly speaking that, but they gave him malchus because he had acted like a lowlife over there and tried to accuse his wife unjustly. The books, the bossam imenu, and then they forced him to pay huksuba. So he did end up getting out of that bad marriage, but like this, he didn't manage to do his plot. Now, Maharsha says the point of it is that we see that just because of Edei Kir would have been alone a reason enough, if it hadn't been for Bava ben Butta coming and saving the day, then they would have thought that there was in fact znus over here, and they would have thought that's reason enough for him to validly be able to divorce her, even though there's no actual edim of znus, just of the Kir. Another point Ben Yehoyada and some of the other Mefarshim make, again, another point as well, is that we see he had to get them drunk to even have them lie in this bed. Like this, if they hadn't been tzaddikim, they would have said, okay, you know, we have no problem lying on that bed. But like this, where when it's with an ashes ish, they're not going to do it unless they were so dead drunk that they didn't know that they didn't know what they were doing. And a related thing to that also is, in other words, Maharsha mentions this point. After all, you could still say, okay, so what? So one of them became a balkeri doesn't necessarily mean that there's nus. But nevertheless, we see also that they were tzaddikim and such a thing wouldn't have happened. If there was something that was going to happen, it would have been outright znus and not just and as it turned out, as Bava ben Butta showed them, it wasn't even that. So Ben Yehoyada also points out a detail. Why does he need friends in plural? Wouldn't it be enough to just have one friend lie on the bed? And he says because then that he figured that'll make people say, you know, it obviously can't be that he made this whole thing up. Would he go to that much trouble to lay both of them on the bed when one would be quite enough to ask her? So that way he hoped to make it that his story would be more believable. But he didn't reckon with Bava ben Butta's with Bava ben Butta's lab test over here.
This guy is amazing. Is Shushmini. Those are the people that sponsored his original.
Well, but again, that's the thing. He had to get them drunk in order for this to even happen. In order for them to even for this to. Otherwise, they would never have gone along with it. Yeah. Okay. So in short, we see from all these three stories, okay, obviously there were individual Rishayim in town. There were always going to be, but by and large, the people there were tzaddikim. Omalei Abaya l'Rab Yosef. So Abaya asked Rab Yosef, "Ma'achad dehavet tzaddikim kolahai? Well, if the people of Kfar Chanya Shel Mitzrayim were such tzaddikim, my time at Yanush. Why indeed were they punished? Why was their city destroyed and all of them were taken into exile or killed or whatever happened to them?" And the answer is Omalei. So Rab Yosef answers, "Mishum deloy i'abul al Yerushalayim, because they did not mourn for the destruction of Yerushalayim." Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, "Simchu es Yerushalayim v'giluva, be rejoiced with Yerushalayim and be happy with it." Kol oyaveha, all of those who love Yerushalayim, sisu ita moses, be joyful and joy with it. Kol misablim alah, all those who mourn from Yerushalayim, for which we learn, kol misablim al Yerushalayim, zeicha v'roy b'simchasa, those who mourn for Yerushalayim will be zeicha to join in its happiness, and the implication is, and those who do not, then not, then they end up having an avelus of their own, Rahman al-Islam. So therefore, so that, now, the Maral explains then, so what is the story doing over here? That's the connection. He says the same way, the people, why were the cities of Tur Malka and the people of them destroyed, and Beta, which we're going to talk about next, is because they also didn't mourn for Yerushalayim. So therefore, the Gemara is bringing the story of Kfaras Chan Yishon Mitzrayim, where they also didn't. The Maharal says, by the way, the vort in it is, he explains, like this we talked about at the beginning of the Sugya, that we have these three places, Yerushalayim, Tur Malka, and Beitar, where the Gemara had mentioned the same pasuk about all three of them. The Maharal explains, among other things, Yerushalayim is like the heart. And these two places, Tur Malka, which was notable for its large population, and Beitar for being a strong fortified city, those are like the right and left arms. Now, if the right and left arms are connected, and the rest of the body are connected to the heart, then very good. But if they get disconnected from the heart, then what happens to them? So the same way, these places, they disconnected themselves from the heart. They didn't consider the fact that Yerushalayim has fallen to be something important and worth mourning for, and therefore this is what happened to them. With Beta, by the way, the Medrash tells us actually in particular as far as Beta that there were actually some people over there were even happy when Yerushalayim was destroyed, because the Medrash tells stories about there were people from Beta who visited Yerushalayim, and the people over there in Yerushalayim would cheat them and do other things. So therefore, some of them were actually happy when those people got what they felt they deserved. But nevertheless, still the Gemara is saying, okay, maybe you want to be happy about those individual people is one thing, but not to be happy about the destruction of Yerushalayim and the Beis Mikdash, the heart of the Jewish people altogether, then that led to this. So the Gemara continues. Ashoka de Rispa Chorov Beta. Now we said at the beginning of the Sugya that because of the side of a wagon and of a carriage, of a coach in particular, Rashi said over there, it's the kind of carriage that noble women would ride in. Because of that, Chorov Beta, Beta was destroyed. What happened? Dehavu Nehigi, they had a minhag there in Beta. Kiyavu Mesialad Yenuka. When a baby boy was born, Shasli Arza, they would plant a cedar tree. Yunukta, and when a girl was born, Shasli Turnissa, they would plant a Turnissa, which is a pine tree. And the point was, when the children get older and they get married, they would chop down those trees, and they would use those trees to make their chuppah. And it was also meant as a symbol. It was also meant as a symbol of that they should continue to grow and that they should be well rooted and strong in the ground, like the way these trees are. One day, the Kaiser, the emperor's daughter, was passing by there. The side of her carriage broke. Kotsu Arza, they chopped down one of the cedar trees. And they used it to fix the wagon. Also, Nofel Olayu, the people, the Jews of Beitar, went and attacked them, Mechunhu, and hit them. And Marashah says the vote was, they figured the Romans, they're not standing because they need a tree. They figured, the same way as you find that Parai tried to kill the baby boys, they're trying to do that symbolically also, to get rid of the bracha for boys. So therefore, they attacked them. But also, Omrei Lekeser, Modebach Yudai, they went back and told the emperor, the Jews are rebelling against you, Osal Laya, when he came and attacked them. So again, this is an example, as we had at the beginning of the Sugya. Asher Adam, Afachid Tomid, happy as unfortunate, as a person who's always worried and concerned about the consequences of his actions, or Makshal Liba, and the stubborn person, Yipa Bara, ends up falling into evil. Yes, they don't like the idea that the Romans are trying to take away their bracha of children, but nevertheless, if they'd thought into it and realized what the consequences are of hitting the Romans over there, then they wouldn't have done that, and now instead the city was destroyed because of that. By the way, you know, we have when it comes to Tisha B'Av, one of the five things that we commemorate on Tisha B'Av is Necher of Beta, and the Rambam points out because it had a huge population, as we're going to say over here in the Gemara, and the destruction of it was a tragedy almost on a par with the destruction of the Beis Mikdash, which is why it's important enough to be considered one of the five things of Tisha B'Av. So the Gemara continues. We have a pasuk in Eicha, Goda Bachori Af Kol Keren Yisrael. Hashem cut down in his furious anger all the Keren of the Jewish people. Keren literally means a horn, but it often means the strength and the beauty. So Amar Rav Zera, Amar Rav Abba, Amar Rav Yechanan. And it also, Marashah points out, the word Keren is also used in connection a lot of times with the strength of a king. Beta was also the last stronghold of Ben Kuziva, Bar Kochva. As the Gemara tells us elsewhere, he ruled in Beta, and then Rabbi Akiva even thought he was Mashiach. So therefore, so Beta, more than any place else, can be described as Keren Yisrael. The Medrash, by the way, has an expression about that that says when after Beta was destroyed, there's not the expression in the Medrash is that the last Keren, the last great power of the Jewish people was broken, and it won't come back till Mashiach comes. Which I guess tells us to put in perspective what the state of Israel is not the Keren Yisrael that it should be by no means. Anyway, so Amar Rav Zera, Amar Rav Abba, Amar Rav Yechon, Elu Shmoinim Elef Kaunim Mochama. The word Keren over here, though, also means a horn, as in like a war horn, that the war trumpet that they blow. So this refers to the 80,000 horn blowers from the Roman army. Kenichas of the Krach Beter, who came into the fortified city of Beter, the Shar Shalach Duha, when they captured it, when they broke into the city. So just the horn blowers, just the people in each Roman army unit who are responsible for blowing the war trumpet to summon their unit to war. Just of them alone, there were 80,000. Vahogavah Noshim of the Noshim Atav, they killed in Beter men, women, and children. There was so much killing that the blood went and flowed into the Yamagadol, into the Mediterranean Sea. You're going to say, oh, well, maybe Beta was close to the sea, so that's going to happen. No, it was a mil away, and nevertheless, there was so much blood that it flowed like that. The Yerushalmi, actually, in Tainus, when it tells about this, actually says even more so. It says, it gives a figure over there, according to different Yerushalmi, of 4 or 40 mil. Nowadays, there's a Jewish town called Beta, not far, and it's as far as historians know, it's fairly close to the ancient Beta, and it is. It's not far from Hebron and Beis Lechem and that whole area, and it's a good distance inland from the Mediterranean, so closer to the Yerushalmi's 40 mil. So the Gemara continues, Tanya Rabbi Yezer Agadol Omer, Shnei Necholam Yesh B'Bikas Yadayim. There are two streams in Bikas Yadayim, is the name of a valley in that area, and it's called Bikas Yadayim, because in fact you have two streams in it that flow in opposite directions, so therefore in that sense they're comparable to hands that go to the hands of a person, each in a different direction. Echad Moshech Elach V'Echad Moshech Elach, each one flows in a different direction. The Shiruch, you know, it splits over there, and you have that each one flows in its own course towards the Mediterranean. The Shiruch Chachamim, after the massacre in Beitar, the Chachamim estimated Shnei Chalokim Mayim Ve'echad Dam, that in those streams there were two parts water and one part blood. That's what an enormous bloodshed there was then. A Medrash says also about it that there was nobody who got alive out from Beta to be able to testify like this. Yeah, if there's any women whose husbands were in the city and they didn't know what happened to them, then they'd need Eidus, what happened to their husbands. Nobody actually managed to get out of the city alive, so there were many Agunis afterwards as well. B'masnisetone, in a braisa we learn, Sheva Shonim Botsru Umasa'olam Askameim, for the next 7 years, the local Goyim were harvesting their vineyards, Midamam Sho Yisrael, from the blood of the Jewish people, Beloy Zevel, without needing fertilizer. In other words, there was so much blood over there that served as fertilizer for them to fertilize their vineyards. The Yerushalmi on this in Tainus mentions also that eventually what happened, that also Adrianus Caesar, the Roman emperor of that time, Hadrian, had a huge vineyard in that area. He had them take the bodies and stack them to make a fence around the vineyard. And with the vineyard, he says there was 18 mil in size. A mil is about a little over half a mile. So you're talking like 10, or 12 miles in circumference. And that's how many bodies there were for him to be able to stack to make a fence around it. Like Gemara mentions elsewhere in Brochus that eventually, years later, they were finally able to get permission from the government to bury them, and there was a nest that none of the bodies had decayed all that time. For that, they made the Brocha in benching. Atoy v'hametiv, the fourth Brocha of benching, was composed at that time. Even Beruigas, in Hashem's fury against the Jewish people, and then this tremendous tragedy and this tremendous bloodshed, nevertheless, Hashem still shows Rachmanis to us, and we continue to commemorate that every time we say the fourth Brocha of benching. among other, there's another time, by the way, when you say the bracha atari v'ametiv is in connection with wine. First of all, when you're benching, there's sometimes going to be alakos, but you also have a din. You have the details of it in Shulchan Aruch and in Urachaim, and in Kofayin Hay about the din of the bracha atari v'ametiv when you have a better quality of wine brought to the table during the meal, and you say the bracha atari v'ametiv. So that's another reason, because the nests happen in kind of the fact that their bodies remained intact all the years was in connection with the vineyards, as we're saying over here, as Yerushalmi says over there. So therefore, the Chacham said to say the bracha over the wine. Why dafka they may? I mean, there's been many nisim throughout Jewish history that we don't commemorate in that way, but one point is because, again, this shows that more so than many other nisim that happened, that as much as Bechori Af with the anger of Hashem, nevertheless, Hashem still shows that he's looking out for us. There's actually an interesting verse from Rav Shamshon Afal Hirsch about it also. He says, you know, after a person has eaten and feels very satisfied, a person is apt to think more highly of his own strength, and therefore that's the kind of thing when a person might think, you know what, even if there's enough of us, we could even go and rebel against the goyim. So therefore, they put it into benching dafka, that at that time, a person should remember, no, look what happened the last time we tried rebelling against the goyim, what a tremendous tragedy came of it, and therefore hold ourselves back and don't do that. Ben Yoyada makes a point over here, by the way. He says like this: we have the bracha that's supposed to come in Hashemayim for the Jewish people is tal, is due, as we're going to have in a few weeks on Pesach, and we daven for it here because the Jewish people didn't deserve it. Instead, tal became zevel, saying gematria. So now the Gemara continues, since we're talking about the tremendous loss of life, the tremendous killings in Beitar. So now the Gemara talks about similarly tremendous massacres that took place at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon. So we'll get back to Beitar afterwards, but first the Gemara digresses a little bit to talk about Churban Bayis Rishon and how many Jews were killed during it. The Gemara says, "Amr of Chiyah ba'Oven, Amr of Yisroel ben Korcha, Sochli Zoken Echad Me'anshi Yerushalayim." An old man from the people of Yerushalayim told me as follows: "Bebikazu in this valley," and he showed him a valley near Yerushalayim. Horag Nevuzaradan Rav Tabochim Mosayim Va'achas Esri Riboy. Nevuzaradan, the chief executioner, the general of Nebuchadnezzar, killed in this valley 211 times 10,000, which is 2,110,000 Jews. Over Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim itself, Horag Tishim Va'ar Beribay. He killed 94 times 10,000, which is 940,000 al Evan Achas, all on one stone. So you're talking just at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, just the killings alone, then we're saying amounts to over 3 million people, to say nothing of all the people who died of starvation and various diseases and whatnot. And Ben Yoyada brings the gematria of Masayim Ba'ah of 211 is Ma'alalei Kael, the deeds of Hashem, meaning that we should realize this wasn't just geopolitics or whatever, this is Hashem making it happen. And the word, the 94 is gematria Domim, as the Gemara is going to say, that this was all as a result of spilling the blood of Zechariah Ben Yoyada, the Kohen. Adcha holach domin v'nogah b'domer shel Zechariah, until their blood spread so far that it touched the blood of Zechariah, who had been killed in the Beis Mikdash a couple hundred years earlier. As the Gemara is going to go on to tell the story, l'kayim mashanema, this fulfills what it says in the pasuk, b'domim nago, blood touches blood. The Navi is saying there's so many murders going on in your area in the Jewish kingdom. And the blood of one victim is touching the blood of another one. So here we're saying that now it has the blood of all these victims that was out and killed touched the blood of Zechariah. What happened? Ashkeche the Domei de Zechariah, this we also had in Daf Yomi a few days ago in Sanhedrin. Ashkeche the Domei de Zechariah, to have a Kamartach v'Solit, Nebuzaradan comes into the Beis Mikdash, and he sees the blood of Zechariah was boiling and bubbling, and it wouldn't stand still. This is Zechariah ben Yehoyada, had lived 250-odd years earlier. He had been, his father was Yehoyada Kohen Gadol. He himself was a Kohen Gadol and a Navi, and he was actually also the king's son-in-law. But he was saying that in his times, King Yehoyash of Yehordan, people in the kingdom were starting to worship Avodah Zarah, and Zechariah goes and tells them a nevuah from Hashem that don't do that, and if you do, then Hashem is going to punish you. So they stoned him and killed him in the Beis Mikdash, and the Medrash actually says on it there were over seven Averis on that day. It was Shabbos, and it was Yom Kippur, and it was in the Beis Mikdash, and he was a Kohen, and he was a Navi, etc. Seven different things. So No, that's not the same Zechariah from today also. That was at the beginning. That Zechariah was the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash. That's Zechariah ben, that's Zechariah ben Berechiah. This one is Zechariah ben Yehoyada. Zechariah is a somewhat common name in Tanakh. I think there are like 20-odd people in Tanakh who bear the name. Anyway. So now, even 250-odd years later, the blood was still there. Omelahu mai hai, and the Rabban asked the Jews, what's this blood over here? Omelahu, so first they tried to use an excuse. Damzvachem de ishtapuch, it was blood of korbanos that spilled, in other words, and that's why it's bubbling, because it's upset, like the spirit of the animal is upset that it didn't get to be brought on the mizbeach. I see dummy, so he Nebuzaradan brought other kinds of blood, or shechted other kinds of animals, or whatever over there, v'lo yidmi, and it didn't look the same. So he realized this isn't animal blood, this is human blood. Omelahus, and Nebuzaradan tells him, if you tell me the truth, mutter than good, v'ilav, and if not, masrikna l'vasaraychu, v'masriki depauzala, then I'll comb your flesh with iron combs, I'll torture you. Amri Leis, so they told him my name, Malach. Well, what can we tell you? We're going to have to tell you the truth. Nevi'ah have a bond. There was a Navi among us. They have a Kamoichachon B'mivi D'Shmaya, who's telling us Musar in matters of Hashem. He's telling us to abandon our Avodah Zarah and go and follow Hashem. Kamin and Ilavei V'Katlin and Lei. We rose up against him and we killed him. V'Hokam Hashnin, D'Loi Kamnayach Dome. And now for many years, his blood is not resting. The Medrash, by the way, tells about this in a couple of places as well. In one place, it has the expression that it wasn't bubbling all the years. Just when the Nebuzaradan came, then Hashem caused it to start bubbling so that it would arouse his, curiosity. Anyway, Omelahu, Nebuzaradan says, I'll appease him. He wants revenge, then fine, I'll take revenge on his behalf. I see Sanhedrin Gdola, Sanhedrin Ktana, Kotilovei, he took the members of the Sanhedrin Gdola and Sanhedrin Ktana and killed them by the blood, Vilay Noch, and it still didn't rest. Bachurim of Sulis, Kotilovei, killed young men and women, Vilay Noch, and it still didn't rest. I see Tinokas, Shabbos Rabban, he brought kids, Cheder children, Kotilovei, and killed them, Vilay Noch, and it still didn't rest. And after 940,000, as I said before, they killed in Yerushalayim, was from this. Finally, Omer Lei says, Zechariah, Tovim Shebehemi Badi, I've already destroyed the best among them. Nichaloch Abdinu Lekulu, do you want me to destroy all of them? Tad Omer Lei Hochi Noch. So when he said that, then the blood calmed down. This was what was necessary essentially for the kapara for those seven averus that are done. We have in Eicha in Megillas Eicha we have the expression in Kechal and Noshim Purim Oly Tipuchim Yumi complains Haytochen that women are having to eat their own children during the siege of Yerushalayim, and the pasuk continues with Hashem answering back in Yehorig B'Mikdash Hashem Kohen B'Navi, and was it right that they killed in the Beis Mikdash a Kohen and a Navi, and therefore like one thing leads to another. We have one of the kinnis that we say on Tisha B'Av goes in detail with this whole story over here. Bahi shaita hir hu tshuva b'dayte. After all of that, and Nebuzaradan started thinking thoughts of tshuva. Omer, he says to himself, imal nefesh achas tkach, madach for one soul, for one person, there was such a tremendous revenge that was taken. Ahu gavra dekoto kolhani nishmosa, that person, meaning I, who killed all those millions of people, alachas kama v'kama, how much more so that I'm in trouble. Orak, he ran away. Ozal shodder shtar putos de bebeise. He sent a will to his house of what they should do with his property, the igaya, and he became a ger. What basin would take such a person as a ger? I have no idea. I guess we have to say that he probably went someplace where nobody knew who he was and just presented himself as Samagoy coming to become a ger, and they didn't know his past. I don't know if they'd known his past, whether they would have accepted him or not. So the Gemara tells that in this connection, speaking of Nebuzaradan becoming a ger, we have other examples like that of famous villains in Jewish history where they themselves or their descendants, great things came out of them. Tonim, we learn in a Braisa, Naaman ger toshav hoya. Naaman was the general of Aram, and the story over there that's in the Haftorah of Parshas Metzorah, became a ger toshav after Elisha cured him of his tzaras. He said, I'm not worshipping Avodah Zarah anymore. Nebuzaradan, Ger Tzedek Hoya, as we just said over here, Nebuzaradan became an actual Ger Tzedek. Other examples, Nibnei Bonav Shal Haman, Limnu Torah B'Bnei Brak, descendants of Haman taught Torah in B'Nei Brak. Now there's different Yosoris over here, and there's an explanation that this actually refers not to someone in B'Nei Brak, but rather Reb Shmuel Bar Shilas, who was an Amorda in Bavel, was mentioned in a number of places in Shas. He was a Melamed of children, but he was also one of the Amoroyim. He himself was a Talmud Chacham, and he was one of the Amiroyim, so there's explanations that this refers to him. Maybe there's a lot of discussion about the fact that you're allowed to accept Gerim from Amalek, and there's a variety of different answers. Maybe, in fact, you are. Maybe he was only descended from Haman on his mother's side, and there's a lot of different explanations about that. Descendants of Sisera taught Jewish children in Cheder in Yerushalayim. Now, there's again different Girsahs about this, and in particular, there's a Girsah of Reb Nissim Goin who identifies this not as a teacher of children, but rather as Rabbi Akiva, that he's descended from Sisera. There's even an explanation that you have. We learned a little while back in Nozir about the whole thing with Sisera and Yoel and how she did an Aveira Lashma to save the Jewish people, and there's an explanation that she became pregnant from that, and Rabbi Akiva is their descendant. With that said, though, Ben Yehoyada says maybe not. The fact that the Gemara does not identify the name may imply that whoever this descendant of Sisera was a simple person. A Melamed, but they're a Melamed, an Erel Chayid, but a sim, but not a famous person. Anyway, Bnei Banav Shal Sancheidav, Limdu Torah Barabim, descendants of Sancheidav, taught Torah in public, Man Inun Shmai of Avtalion, named the Shmai and Avtalion, who are descended from Sancheidav. The Rambam holds that they themselves, in fact, were Gerim. Usually, by the way, you don't appoint Gerim to a position of distinction over the Jewish people, but there's one explanation, because there was nobody else of their caliber at that time. So we see that there's a number of these examples where great people come out of notorious Rishoyim. One point is, there's a vote brought from Olivia Soboditchever on this that says that with each one of them, a tremendous Kiddush Hashem was made in the world because each of them was punished in their own way. Haman in his way, and Sisera in his way, and then Sancheiriv in his way, and therefore there came a Kiddush Hashem out of it ultimately, and therefore it could come out that they have good Jewish descendants. So the Gemara says, "Hainu dechtiv." The story with Zechariah and his blood is like the pasuk says in Yechezkel, "Nasatias domal tziach solal avilti kothes." With all the murders in Yerushalayim, the Navi is saying, "I placed the blood on a bare rock that it won't be covered." So here, in other words, it didn't get absorbed in the ground, which is exactly what happened with Zechariah's blood, where it was still there all these hundreds of years later, and there was all this catastrophe that happened because of it. There is, by the way, famously, the Rebbe talked about Nesicha in connection. You have the whole thing with Miriam Bas Bilga, where the Rebbe defended her, and afterwards people asked, "Are you talking? You're defending such a notorious Rashanta," when the Gemara says such horrible things about her, and the Rebbe brought in that connection a story attributed to the Alter Rebbe, where there's a fellow who's suffering from a dibuk. There's an neshama that got stuck to his own and is causing trouble, and the Kitzur HaMaaseh, the Alter Rebbe goes to talk with it, and the guy explains he was one of the people who was involved in killing the Chai, and therefore he's over and over. He has no rest since then. Every time there's Gilgal, he has no rest. And then the Alter Rebbe is Melamed Tzvus on him that after all, the Chaya was going to tell them that if they keep up what they're doing, the Bais HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. And they wanted to prevent him from saying that, because until the Nevuah is actually said, it doesn't necessarily have to come true. And therefore, that's a certain limit Tzvus on it. And that was able to help that neshama, and it was able to have its tikkun. Yemiyah Mashiach Ogo'ola, Hafvav Odebeis, continuing on the subject of, actually called Zion Odebeis is today. So you have the concept called Mitzvahs Mikelos La'osid Lover. You have the idea that the Gemara says that Mitzvahs will be bottle in the future. There's such an opinion in the Gemara. Meaning in the time of Tchias HaMeisim, the second period of Yemos HaMashiach, as opposed to the time before Tchias HaMeisim, then of course we're going to be doing Mitzvahs in the most perfect possible way. The result of that comes out of the practical halacha, therefore that if you have a piece of clothing that you don't know whether there's kelayim in it, then you allowed to use it as tachrichim lames, and Rabbi Yosef says in the Gemara, from here we see that mitzvahs v'teilus loss of lavoi, because even when the person comes alive by tchias ha'meisim, doesn't matter that he's going to be wearing kalayim or possible kalayim, because the mitzvahs won't be in effect. Now, what does that mean exactly? So the Rebbe talks about in Kuntres Halochas Shal Torah Shabal Pesha in B'Kelim Lo'ilam, that it means, in other words, that at that point you have the mitzvah itself still exists, but the person doesn't have the tzivui. At that point, the mitzvah only exists as Ritzoy Nishal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Rebbe discusses it in some detail. Continuing on Eruv Tchumen. So if a person does need to go on Shabbos outside the Tchum, then he has to put down an Eruv Tchum before Shabbos or before Yom Tov. It has to be within the Tchum. It has to be, in other words, he should be able to reach it before Shabbos. So for example, again, you see, staying in a bungalow colony, let's say, then it has to be within 2,000 amas or 2,070 amas or whatever of the edge of the colony. And then the point of it is, you put food over there, it's considered as though you live over there. So therefore, what it is it shifts your Tchum. So what you gain in one direction, you lose in the other direction. So let's say you put it to 2,000 amas west of your bungalow colony, let's say, for example, so it means you can walk an extra 2,000 amas to the west, but now you can't walk east outside of your colony at all. And then the same way with any other figure like that. So it's always you have a form of 2,000 amos, but instead of having it centered on where you actually are spending Shabbos, you have it centered on the place where you put the food. Is the idea behind the Erev Tchumen.